need socks, I can lend you.
No, I've got enough of my own, thanks.
He takes a deep breath, closes his eyes to get his panic under control, and goes to the right cubby. The sock with the detonators is there. He slips it into his pocket.
You okay, Lev? You look kind of funny.
I'm fine. I've just been running, that's all. Running on the treadmill.
No, you haven't, says the kid. I was just in the gym.
Listen, mind your own business, okay? I'm not your buddy. I'm not your friend.
But we ought to be friends.
No, you don't know me. I'm not like you, okay? So just leave me alone.
Then he hears a deeper voice behind him.
That's enough, Lev.
He turns to see a man in a suit. It's not one of the pastors, but the counselor who admitted him a week ago.
This can't be good.
The counselor nods to the tow-headed kid.
Thank you, Sterling.
The boy casts his eyes down and hurries out.
We assigned Sterling to keep an eye on you and make sure you're adjusting. We are, to say the least, concerned.
Lev sits in a room with the counselor and two pastors. The sock bulges in his pocket. He bounces his knees nervously, then remembers he's not supposed to make any jarring motions, or he might detonate. He forces himself to stop.
You seem troubled, Lev, says the counselor.
We'd like to understand why.
Lev looks at the clock. It's 12:48. 12 minutes until he, Mai, and Blaine are supposed to meet and take care of business.
Being tithed, Lev says. Isn't that enough of a reason?
The younger of the two pastors leans forward.
We try to make sure every tithe enters the divided state in the proper frame of mind.
We wouldn't be doing our job if we didn't try to make things right for you, says the elder pastor,
then offers a smile so forced it's more like a grimace. Lev wants to scream at them, but he knows that won't get him out of here any faster.
I just don't like being around other kids right now. I'd rather prepare for this alone, okay?
But it's not okay, says the older pastor. That's not the way we do things here. Everyone supports one another.
The junior pastor leans forward.
You need to give the other boys a chance. They're all good kids.
Well, maybe I'm not. Lev can't help but look at the clock again. 12:50. Mai and Blaine will be in place in 10 minutes. And what if he's still here in this stinking office? Won't that be just great?
Have somewhere you need to be? The counselor asks. You keep checking the time.
Lev knows his answer needs to make sense, or they truly will become suspicious of him.
I heard the kid who kidnapped me was being unwound today. I was just wondering if it had happened yet.
The pastors look at one another and at the counselor, who leans back in his chair as calm as can be.
If he hasn't been, he will be shortly.
Lev, I think it would be healthy for you to discuss what happened to you while you were held hostage.
I'm sure it was horrible,
but talking about it can take away the power of the memory. I'd like to hold a special group tonight with your unit. It'll be a time for you to share with the others what you've been holding inside. I think you'll find they'll be very understanding.
Tonight, Lev says.
Okay, fine. I'll talk about everything tonight.
Maybe you're right and it'll make me feel better.
We just want to ease your mind, says one of the pastors.
So can I go now?
The counselor studies him for a moment more.
You seem so tense. I'd like to talk you through some guided relaxation exercises.
63. Guard. He hates his job. He hates the heat. He hates that he has to stand in front of the chop shop for hours guarding the doors, making sure no one unauthorized enters or leaves. He had dreams back in Steho of starting a business with his buddies. But no one loans startup money to Steho kids. Even after he changed his last name from Ward to Mullard, the name of the richest family in town, he couldn't fool anyone.
Turns out half the kids from his state home took on that name when they left, figuring they could outsmart the world. In the end, he outsmarted no one but himself. The best he could do was find a series of unfulfilling jobs in the year he's been out of Steho, the most recent of which is being a harvest camp guard. On the roof, the band has started its afternoon set. At least that helps the time to pass a little more quickly. Two unwinds approach and climb the steps toward him. They're not being escorted by guards, and both carry plates covered with aluminum foil. The guard doesn't like the look of them. The boy's a fleshhead. The girl is Asian. What do you want? You're not supposed to be here.
We were told to give this to the band.
They both look nervous and shifty. This is nothing new. All unwinds get nervous near the chop shop. And to the guard, all unwinds look shifty. The guard peeks under the aluminum foil. Roast chicken, mashed potatoes. They do send food up to the band once in a while, but usually it's staff that carries the food, not unwinds. I thought they just had lunch.
Guess not, says the fleshhead.
He looks like he'd rather be anywhere in the world but standing in front of the chop shop, so the guard decides to draw it out, making them stand there even longer.
I'll have to call this in, he says.
He pulls out his phone and calls the front office. He gets a busy signal. Typical. The guard wonders which he'd get in more trouble for, letting them bring the food in or turning them away if they really were sent by administration. He considers the plate in the girl's hands. Let me see that. He peels back the foil and takes the largest chicken breast. Go in through the glass doors and the stairs are to your left. If I see you go anywhere but up the stairs, I'll come in there and trank you so fast you won't know what hit you. Once they're inside, they're out of sight, out of mind. He doesn't know that although they went into the stairwell, they never brought the food to the band. They just ditched the plates. And he never noticed the little round band-aids on their palms.
64. Connor.
Connor looks out of the dormitory window, devastated. Lev is here at Happy Jack. How he got here doesn't matter. All that matters is that Lev will now be unwound. It's all been for nothing. Connor's sense of futility makes him feel like a part of himself has already been cut out and taken to market. Connor Lassiter? He turns to see two guards at the entrance. Around him, most of the kids have left the unit for their afternoon activity. The ones that remain take a quick glance at the guards and at Connor, then look away, busying themselves in anything that will keep them out of this business.
Yeah? What do you want?
Your presence is requested at the Harvest Clinic, says the first guard.
The other guard doesn't talk. He just chomps on chewing gum. Connor's first reaction is that this can't be what it sounds like. Maybe Risa sent them. Maybe she wants to play something for him. After all, now that she's in the band, she has more influence than the average unwind, doesn't she?
The Harvest Clinic, echoes Connor. What for?
Well, let's just say you're leaving Happy Jack today.
Chomp, chomp, goes the other guard.
Leaving? Come on, son, do we have to spell it out for you? You're a problem here. Too many of the other kids look up to you. And that's never a good thing at a harvest camp. So the administration decided to take care of the problem.
They advance on Connor, lifting him up by the arms.
No. No, you can't do this.
We can, and we are. It's our job. Whether you make it hard or easy, it doesn't matter. Our job gets done either way.
Connor looks to the other kids as if they might help him, but they don't.
Goodbye, Connor, says one, but he won't even look in Connor's direction.
The gum-chewing guard looks more sympathetic, which means there might be a way to get through to him. Connor looks at him pleadingly. It makes him stop chewing for an instant. The guard thinks for a moment and says,
I got a buddy looking for brown eyes on account of his girlfriend don't like the ones he's got. He's a decent guy. You could do a lot worse.
What?
We sometimes get dibs on parts and stuff, he says. One of the perks of the job. Anyways, all I'm saying is I can give you some peace of mind. You know your eyes won't go to some lowlife or nothing.
The other guard snickers. Peace of mind. Good one. Okay, time to go. They pull Connor forward and he tries to prepare himself. But how do you prepare yourself for something like this? Maybe what they say is right. Maybe it's not dying. Maybe it's just passing into a new form of living. It could be all right, couldn't it? Couldn't it?
He tries to imagine what it must be like for an inmate to be led to his execution. Do they fight it?
Connor tries to imagine himself kicking and screaming his way to the chop shop. But what would be the use of that? If his time on Earth as Connor Lassiter is ending, then maybe he should use the time well. He should allow himself to spend his final moments appreciating who he was. No, who he still is. He should appreciate the last breaths moving in and out of his lungs while those lungs are still under his control. He should feel the tension and release in his muscles as he moves, and see the many sights of Happy Jack with his eyes and store them in his brain. Hands off me. I'll walk by myself.
He orders the guards, and they instantly release him, perhaps surprised by the authority in his voice. He rolls his shoulders, cracks his neck, and strides forward. The first step is the hardest, but from that moment on he decides that he will neither run nor dawdle. He will neither quiver nor fight. He will take this last walk of his life in steady strides. And in a few weeks from now, someone, somewhere, will hold in their mind the memory that this young man, whoever he was, faced his unwinding with dignity and pride.
65. Clappers.
Who can say what goes through the mind of a clapper in the moments before carrying out that evil deed? No doubt whatever those thoughts are, they are lies. However, like all dangerous deceptions, the lies that clappers tell themselves wear seductive disguises. For clappers who have been led to believe their acts are smiled upon by God, their lie is clothed in holy robes and has outstretched arms promising a reward that will never come. For clappers who believe their act will somehow bring about change in the world, their lie is disguised as a crowd looking back at them from the future, smiling in appreciation for what they've done. For clappers who seek only to share their personal misery with the world, their lie is an image of themselves, freed from their pain by witnessing the pain of others. And for clappers who are driven by vengeance, their lie is a scale of justice, weighed evenly on both sides, finally in balance. It is only when a clapper brings his hands together that the lie reveals itself, abandoning the clapper in that final instant so that he exits this world utterly alone, without so much as a lie to accompany him into oblivion. Or her. The path that brought Mai to this place in her life was full of fury and disappointment. Her breaking point was Vincent. He was a boy no one knew. He was a boy she met and fell in love with in the warehouse more than a month ago. He was a boy who died in midair, crammed into a crate with four other kids who choked on their own carbon dioxide. No one seemed to notice his disappearance, and certainly no one cared. No one but Mai, who had found her soulmate and had lost him that day she arrived in the graveyard. The world was to blame. But when she secretly witnessed the Admiral's Golden Five burying Vincent and the others, she was able to give faces to her fury. The Goldens buried Vincent not with respect, but with profanities. They cracked jokes and laughed. They covered the five dead boys carelessly with dirt like cats cover their turds. Mai had never felt such rage. Once Cleaver befriended her, she told him what she had seen, and he agreed that revenge was in order. It was Cleaver's idea to kill the Goldens. It was Blaine who drugged them and brought them to the FedEx jet, but it was Mai who sealed the hatch of the crate. It was amazing to her that killing could be as easy as closing a door. After that, there was no turning back for Mai. Her bed had been made. All that remained was for her to lie in it. She knows that today will be the day she climbs in and goes to her rest. Once inside the chop shop, she finds a storage room full of surgical gloves,
syringes and shiny instruments she cannot identify. She knows Blaine is somewhere in the north wing of the building. She expects Lev is in position too, standing on the loading dock at the back of the chop shop. At least that's the plan. It is now 1 o'clock on the nose. Time to do this. Mai enters the storage room and closes the door, and waits. She will do this, but not quite yet. Let one of the others go. She refuses to be the first. Blaine waits in a deserted hallway on the second floor. This area of the chop shop doesn't appear to be in use. He has decided not to use his detonators. Detonators are for wimps. For a hardcore clapper, a single powerful clap is enough to bring it on, even without detonators. Blaine wants to believe he's hardcore, like his brother was. He stands at the end of the hallway, legs spread to shoulder width, bouncing on the balls of his feet like a tennis player awaiting a serve. His hands are held apart, but he waits. He's hardcore, yes, but he's not going first. Lev is convinced the psychologist that he's suitably relaxed. It's the best acting performance of his life, because his heart is racing and there's so much adrenaline flooding his blood, he's afraid he'll spontaneously combust.
Why don't you go back to the tithing house? The doctor suggests. Spend some time getting to know the other kids. Make an effort, Lev. You'll be glad you did.
Yes. Yes, I'll do that. Thank you. I feel better now.
Good.
The counselor motions to the pastors and everyone rises. It's 1:04. Lev wants to race out the door, but he knows that will just get him another therapy session. He leaves the office with the pastors, who babble about his place in the scheme of things and the joys of tithing. It's only as Lev gets outside that he becomes aware of the commotion. Kids are all running from their activities and into the commons between the dormitories and the chop shop. Have Blaine and Mai gone off already? He didn't hear any explosions. No, this is something else.
It's the Akron AWOL!
He hears one of the kids shout.
He's being unwound!
That's when Lev spots Connor. He's halfway down the red carpet, marching with two guards right behind him. Kids have gathered in the grassy commons, but they keep their distance as more kids arrive. They're spilling out of the dormitories, the dining hall, everywhere. The band has stopped playing in the middle of a tune. The keyboardist, a girl, wails at the sight of Connor on the red stone path. Connor looks up at her, halts for a second, and blows her a kiss before continuing on. Lev can hear her crying. Now guards, staffers, and counselors converge on the quad in panic, trying to herd this volatile gathering of kids back to their places, but no one will leave. The kids just stand there. Maybe they can't stop this, but they can witness it. They can be there as Connor strides out of this life.
Let's hear it for the Akron AWOL!
One boy shouts.
Let's hear it for Connor!
And he starts to applaud. Soon the entire crowd of kids is applauding and cheering Connor as he marches down the red carpet. Applause. Clapping. Mai and Blaine. Suddenly Lev realizes what's about to happen. He can't let Connor go in there. Not now. He's got to stop him. Lev breaks away from the pastors. Connor is almost to the steps of the chop shop. Lev races between the kids, but he can't push his way through them. If he does, he knows he'll detonate. He must be quick, but he must be careful, and being careful slows him down.
Connor!
He screams. But the cheers all around him are too loud, and now the band has begun to play again. They're playing the national anthem, just like they do at the funerals of great Americans. The guards and the staff can't stop this. They try, but they can't. And they're so busy trying to control the crowd, they let Lev slip right past onto the red carpet. Now he has a clear path to Connor, who has begun climbing the steps. Lev screams his name again, but Connor still can't hear. Although Lev races down the path, he's still 20 yards away when the glass doors open and Connor steps inside with the guards.
No! Connor, no!
But the doors close. Connor is inside the chop shop. But he won't be unwound. He's going to die just like everyone else inside. and as if to complete Lev's failure, he finally takes a look up at the roof to catch the gaze of the keyboard player looking down at him. It's Risa. How could he have been so stupid? He should have known it was her from the way she wailed, and from the kiss that Connor blew her. Lev stands there, petrified with disbelief. And then the world comes to an end. Blaine still stands at the end of the hall waiting for someone else to go first.
Hey, who are you? What are you doing here?
A guard shouts at Blaine.
Stay back,
Blaine says.
Stay back or else.
The guard pulls out his trank pistol and speaks into his radio.
I got an unwind loose up here. I need backup.
I'm warning you, says Blaine. But the guard knows exactly how to deal with an unwind loose in the chop shop. He aims his trank gun at Blaine's left thigh and fires.
No!
But it's too late. The impact of the trank bullet is more effective than any detonator. Blaine and the guard are instantly incinerated as the 6 quarts of liquid explosive coursing through Blaine's body ignites. Mai hears the explosion. It shakes the entire storage room like an earthquake. She doesn't think about it. She can't. Not anymore. She looks at the detonators on her palm. This is for Vincent. This is for her parents who signed the unwind order. This is for the whole world. She claps once. Nothing. She claps twice. Nothing. She claps a third time. The third time is the charm. The moment Risa sees Lev standing below, on the red carpet, an explosion rips through the north wing of the chop shop. She turns to see the entire wing crumble.
Oh my God! Oh my God!
We gotta get out of here!
Yells Dalton. But before he can make a move, a second explosion roars beneath him, sending the air vent cap shooting skyward like rockets. The roof beneath their feet cracks like thin ice, and the entire roof gives way. Risa plunges with the rest of the band into the smoky abyss, and in that instant, all she can think of is Connor, and how the band never got to finish playing his farewell anthem. Lev stands there as the glass blows past him. He sees the band fall as the roof collapses. A howl builds up inside him, escaping his mouth, an inhuman sound born of an agony he can't describe. His world has truly ended. Now he must finish the job. Standing there before the ruined building, he pulls out the sock in his pocket. He fumbles with it until he finds the detonators. He peels the backs, revealing the adhesive, and sticks them to his palms. They look like stigmata, the nail wounds in the hands of Christ. Still wailing his agony, he holds his hands up before him, preparing to make the pain go away. He holds his hands up before him. He holds his hands up before him. He holds his hands up before him. And he cannot bring them together. He wants to. He needs to. But he can't.
Make this go away. Please. Somebody make this all go away.
No matter how hard he tries, no matter how much his mind wants to end this here and now, another part of him, a stronger part of him, refuses to let him clap his hands together. Now he is even a failure as a failure.
God, dear God, what am I doing? What have I done? How did I get here?
The crowd, which had run at the sound of the blast, has come back. They ignore Lev because there's something else they see.
Look!
Someone shouts.
Look!
Lev turns to see where the kid is pointing. Coming out of the ruined glass doors of the chop shop is Connor. He's stumbling. His face is a shredded, bloody mess. He's lost an eye. His right arm is crushed and mangled, but he's alive.
Connor blew up the chop shop!
Someone yells.
He blew it up and saved us all!
And then a guard bursts onto the scene.
Get back to your dormitories, all of you, now!
No one moves.
Didn't you hear me?
Then a kid slams the guard with a right hook that practically spins his whole body around. The guard responds by pulling out his trank gun and shooting the kid in the offending arm. The kid goes to dreamland, but there are other kids, and they tear the gun out of the guard's hand, using it against him, just like Connor once had. The word that the Akron AWOL blew up the chop shop zigs like lightning through every Unwind and Happy Jack, and in seconds, disobedience erupts into a full-scale revolt. Every terrible is now a terror. The guards fire, but there are simply too many kids and not enough trank bullets. For every kid that goes down, there's another kid that doesn't. The guards are quickly overwhelmed, and once they are, the mob starts storming the front gate. Connor has no understanding of this event. All he knows is that he was led into the building, then something happened. And now he's not in the building anymore. His face is wrong. It hurts. It hurts bad. He can't move his arm. The ground feels strange beneath his feet. His lungs hurt. He coughs, and they hurt more. He's stumbling down steps now. There are kids here. Lots of kids. Unwinds. That's right, he's an Unwind. They're all Unwinds. But the meaning of that is slipping from him fast. The kids are running. They're fighting. Then Connor's legs give out. Suddenly he's on the ground, looking up at the sun. He wants to sleep. He knows this isn't a good place, but he wants to anyway. He feels wet. Feels sticky. Is his nose running? Then there's an angel hovering above him, all in white. "Don't move," the angel says. Connor recognizes the voice.
"Hi, Lev. How are things?"
"Shh. My arm hurts," Connor says lazily.
"Did you bite me again?"
Then Lev does something funny. He takes off his shirt, and he tears his shirt in half. He presses half the torn shirt to Connor's face. That makes his face hurt more. He groans. Then Lev takes the other half of his shirt and ties it around Connor's arm. He ties it tight. That hurts too.
"Hey, what?"
"Don't try to talk. Just relax." There are others around him now. He doesn't know who. A kid holding a trank pistol looks at Lev, and Lev nods. Then the kid kneels down next to Connor. "This is going to hurt a little," says the kid with the trank gun, "but I think you need it." He aims uncertainly at various parts of Connor's body, then settles on Connor's hip. Connor hears the gunshot, feels a sharp pain in his hip, and as his vision begins to darken, he sees Lev hurrying shirtless toward a building that's pouring out black smoke.
"Weird," says Connor.
Then his mind goes to a quiet place where none of this matters. Part 7. Consciousness. A human being is part of a whole, called by us the universe, a part limited in time and space. He experiences himself, his thoughts and feelings, as something separated from the rest, a kind of optical delusion of his consciousness. This delusion is a kind of prison for us. Our task must be to free ourselves from this prison by widening our circles of compassion to embrace all living creatures and the whole of nature and its beauty. Albert Einstein. Two things are infinite, the universe and human stupidity. And I'm not sure about the universe. Albert Einstein. 66. Connor. Connor regains consciousness with nothing but hazy confusion where his thoughts ought to be. His face aches, and he can see out of only one eye. He feels pressure over his other eye. He's in a white room. There's a window through which he can see daylight. This is unquestionably a hospital room, and that pressure over his eye must be a bandage. He tries to lift his right arm, but there's an ache in his shoulder, so he decides it's not worth the effort just yet. Only now does he begin to piece together the events that landed him here. He was about to be unwound. There was an explosion. There was a revolt. Then Lev was standing over him. That's all he can remember. A nurse comes into the room.
"So you're finally awake. How are you feeling?"
"Good," he says.
his voice little more than a croak. He clears his throat.
How long?
You've been in a medically induced coma for a little over 2 weeks, says the nurse.
2 weeks?
With a life that has been lived day to day for so long, 2 weeks sounds like an eternity.
And Risa? What about Risa?
There was a girl, he says. She was on the roof of the harvest clinic. Does anyone know what happened to her?
The nurse's expression doesn't give anything away. That can all be sorted out later.
But
no buts. Right now you need time to heal.
And I have to say you're doing better than anyone expected, Mr. Mullard.
His first thought is that he hasn't heard her right. He shifts uncomfortably.
Excuse me?
She fluffs his pillows.
Just relax now, Mr. Mullard. Let us handle everything.
His second thought is that he's been unwound after all. He's been unwound and somehow someone got his entire brain. He's inside someone else now. But as he thinks about it, he knows that can't be it. His voice still sounds like his voice. When he rubs his tongue against his teeth, those teeth are still the ones he remembers.
My name is Connor, he tells her. Connor Lassiter.
The nurse studies him with an expression that's kind, but calculated, almost disturbingly so.
Well, she says, as it so happens, an ID with the picture charred off was found in the wreckage. It belonged to a 19-year-old guard by the name of Elvis Mullard. With all the confusion after the blast, there really was no telling who was who, and many of us agreed that it would be a shame to let that ID go to waste. Don't you agree?
She reaches over and adjusts the angle of Connor's bed until he's sitting up more comfortably.
Now tell me, she asks, what was your name again?
Connor gets it. He closes his eye, takes a deep breath, and opens it again. Do I have a middle name? The nurse checks the chart.
Robert.
Then my name is E. Robert Mullard. The nurse smiles and holds out her hand to shake his.
A pleasure to meet you, Robert.
As a reflex, Connor reaches out his right hand toward hers and gets that dull ache in his shoulder again.
Sorry,
says the nurse. My fault. She shakes his left hand instead.
Your shoulder will feel a bit sore until the graft is completely healed.
What did you just say?
The nurse sighs.
Me and my big mouth. The doctors always want to be the ones to tell you, but the cat's out of the bag now, isn't it? Well, the bad news is that we weren't able to save your arm or your right eye. The good news is that as E. Robert Mullard, you qualified for emergency transplants. I've seen the eye. Don't worry, it's a decent match. As for the arm, well, the new one is a little more muscular than your left one, but some good physical therapy can even that out in no time.
Connor lets it sink in, playing it over in his mind.
Eye? Arm? Physical therapy?
I know it's a lot to get used to, says the nurse.
For the first time, Connor looks at his new hand. There are bandages padding his shoulder, and his arm is in a sling. He flexes the fingers. They flex. He twists his wrist. It twists. The fingernails need clipping, and the knuckles are thicker than his own. He runs his thumb across the pads of his fingertips. The sense of touch is just as it ever was. Then he rotates his wrist a bit farther and stops. He feels a wave of panic surge through him, one that resolves into a knot deep in his gut. The nurse grins as she looks at the arm.
Parts often come with their own personalities, she says. Nothing to worry about.
You must be hungry. I'll get you some lunch.
Yeah, says Connor. Lunch. That's good. She leaves him alone with the arm. His arm. An arm that bears the unmistakable tattoo of a tiger shark.
67. Risa.
Risa's life as she knew it ended the day the Clappers blew up the chop shop, and everyone eventually did learn that it was Clappers, not Connor. The evidence was indisputable, especially after the confession of the clapper who survived. Unlike Connor, Risa never lost consciousness. Even though she was pinned beneath a steel I-beam, she stayed wide awake. As she lay there in the wreckage, some of the pain she felt when the I-beam came down on her was gone. She didn't know whether that was a good sign or bad. Dalton was in lots of pain, though. He was terrified. Risa calmed him down. She talked to him, telling him it was all right, that everything would be fine. She kept telling him that right up until the moment he died. The guitar player had been luckier. He was able to wrestle himself out from under the debris, but he couldn't free Risa, so he left, promising her he'd send back help. He must have kept his promise, because help finally did come. It took 3 people to lift the beam, but only 1 to carry her out. Now she rests in a hospital room, trussed up in a contraption that looks more like a torture device than a bed. She is riddled with steel pins like a human voodoo doll. The pins are held in precise place by rigid scaffolding. She can see her toes, but she can't feel them. From now on, seeing them will have to be enough.
You have a visitor.
A nurse stands at the door, and when she steps aside, Connor is standing in the doorway. He's bruised and bandaged, but very much alive. Her eyes instantly fill with tears, but she knows she can't let herself sob. It still hurts too much to sob.
I knew they were lying, she says. They said you died in the explosion, that you were trapped in the building. But I saw you outside. I knew they were lying.
I probably would have died, Connor said. But Lev stopped the bleeding. He saved me.
He saved me too, Risa tells him. He carried me out of the building.
Connor smiles. Not bad for a lousy little tithe. By the look on his face, Risa can tell he doesn't know that Lev was one of the clappers, the one who didn't go off. She decides not to tell him. It's still all over the news. He'll know soon enough. Connor tells her of his coma and about his new identity. Risa tells him how few of Happy Jack's AWOLs have been caught, how the kid stormed the gates and escaped. She glances at his sling as they speak. The fingers sticking out of that arm sling are definitely not Connor's. She knows what must have happened, and she can tell he's self-conscious about it. So what do they say? Connor asks. About your injuries, I mean. You're going to be okay, right? Risa considers how she might tell him, then just decides to be quick about it.
They tell me I'm paralyzed from the waist down.
Connor waits for more, but that's all she has to give him.
Well, that's not so bad, right? They can fix that. They're always fixing that. Yes, says Risa. They fix it by replacing a severed spine with the spine of an unwind. That's why I refused the operation.
He looks at her in disbelief, and she in turn points at his arm.
You would have done the same thing if they'd given you a choice. Well, I had a choice, and I made it.
I'm so sorry, Risa.
Don't be.
The one thing she doesn't want from Connor is pity.
They can't unwind me now. There are laws against unwinding the disabled. But if I got the operation, they'd unwind me the moment I was healed. This way I get to stay whole.
She smiles at him triumphantly.
So you're not the only one who beat the system.
He smiles at her and rolls his bandaged shoulder. The sling shifts, exposing more of his new arm, enough to reveal the tattoo. He tries to hide it, but it's too late. She sees it. She knows it. And when she meets Connor's eye, he looks away in shame.
Connor?
I promise, he says. I promise I will never touch you with this hand. Risa knows this is a crucial moment for both of them. That arm, the same one that held her back against a bathroom wall. How could she look at it now with anything but disgust? Those fingers that threatened unspeakable things. How can they make her feel anything but revulsion? But when she looks at Connor, all that fades away. There's only him.
Let me see it, she says.
Connor hesitates, so she reaches out and gently slips it from the sling.
Does it hurt?
A little, She brushes her fingers across the back of his hand.
Can you feel that?
Connor nods. Then she gently lifts the hand to her face, pressing the palm to her cheek. She holds it there for a moment, then lets go, letting Connor take over. He moves his hand across her cheek, wiping away a tear with his finger. He softly strokes her neck and she closes her eyes. She feels as he moves his fingertips across her lips before he takes his hand away. Risa opens her eyes and takes the hand in hers, clasping it tightly.
I know this is your hand now, she tells him. Roland would never have touched me like that.
Connor smiles, and Risa takes a moment to look down at the shark on his wrist. It holds no fear for her now, because the shark has been tamed by the soul of a boy. No, the soul of a man. 68. Lev. Not far away in a high-security federal detention center, Levi Jedediah Calder is held in a cell designed for his very specific needs. The cell is padded. There is a steel blast door 3 inches thick. The room is kept at a constant 45 degrees Fahrenheit to keep Lev's body temperature from rising too high. Lev is not cold, though. In fact, he's hot. He's hot because he's wrapped in layer after layer of fire-resistant insulation. He looks like a mummy, suspended in mid-air. But unlike a mummy, his hands aren't crossed over his chest. They're held out to each side and lashed to a crossbeam so he cannot bring his hands together. The way Lev sees it, they didn't know whether to crucify him or mummify him, so they did both. This way, he can't clap, he can't fall, he can't inadvertently detonate himself. And if for some reason he does, the cell is designed to withstand the blast. They've given him 4 transfusions. They won't tell him how many more he'll need until the explosive is out of his system. They won't tell him anything. The federal agents who come visit him are only interested in what he can tell them. They've given him a lawyer who talks about insanity like it's a good thing. Lev keeps telling him that he isn't insane, although he's not even sure himself anymore. The door to his cell opens. He expects another interrogation, but his visitor is someone new. It takes a moment for Lev to recognize him, mainly because he's not wearing his modest pastor's vestments. He wears jeans and a striped button-down shirt.
Good morning, Lev. Pastor Dan?
The door slams closed behind him, but it doesn't echo. The soft walls absorb the sound. Pastor Dan rubs his arms against the cold. They should have told him to bring a jacket.
Are they treating you okay?
He asks.
Yeah, says Lev. The good thing about being explosive is that no one can beat you.
Pastor Dan gives an obligatory chuckle, then awkwardness takes over. He forces himself to meet Lev's eyes.
I understand they'll only keep you wrapped up like this for a few weeks, until you're out of the woods.
Lev wonders which particular woods he means. Certainly his life will now be one dark forest within another. Lev doesn't even know why the pastor is here, or what he hopes to prove. Should Lev be happy to see him, or should he be mad? This is the man who always told him that tithing was a holy thing from the time he was a small boy, and then told him to run from it. Is Pastor Dan here to reprimand him? To congratulate him? Did Lev's parents send him because he's so untouchable now, they won't come themselves? Or maybe Lev's about to be executed and he's here to give last rites.
Why don't you just get it over with?
Lev says.
Get what over with? Whatever you're here to do, do it and go.
There are no chairs in the room, so Pastor Dan leans back against the padded wall.
How much have they told you about what's going on out there? All I know is what goes on in here, which isn't much.
Pastor Dan sighs, rubs his eyes, and takes his time to consider where to begin.
First of all, do you know a boy by the name of Cyrus Finch?
The mention of his name makes Lev begin to panic. Lev knew his background would be checked and rechecked. That's what happens to clappers. Their whole life becomes pages pasted on a wall to be examined, and the people in their lives become suspects. Of course, That usually happens after the clapper has applauded his way into the next world.
Sci-fi had nothing to do with this, says Lev. Nothing at all. They can't pull him into this.
Calm down, he's fine. It just so happens that he's come forward and is making a big stink, and since he knew you, people are listening.
A stink about me?
About unwinding, says Pastor Dan for the first time, moving closer to Lev. What happened at Happy Jack Harvest Camp? Got a whole lot of people talking. People who had just been burying their heads in the sand. There have even been protests in Washington against unwinding. Cyrus even testified before Congress. Lev tries to imagine Sci-Fi in front of a congressional committee, trash-talking them in pre-war sitcom Umber. The thought of it makes Lev smile. It's the first time he's smiled in a long time. There's talk that they might even lower the legal age of adulthood from 18 to 17. That'll save a full fifth of all the kids marked for unwinding.
That's good, says Lev.
Pastor Dan reaches into his pocket and pulls out a folded piece of paper. I wasn't going to show you this, but I think you need to see it. I think you need to understand where things have gone. It's the cover of a magazine. Lev's on it. Not just on it, Lev is the cover. It's his seventh grade baseball picture, mitt in hand, smiling at the camera. The headline reads, "Why, Lev? Why?" In all the time he's had here alone to think and rethink his actions, it never occurred to him that the outside world had been doing the same thing. He doesn't want this attention, but now he's apparently on a first-name basis with the world. You've been on the cover of just about every magazine. He didn't need to know that. He hopes that Pastor Dan doesn't have a whole collection of them in his pocket.
So what?
Lev says, trying to act as if it doesn't matter.
Clappers always make the news.
Their actions make the news. The destruction they've caused. But nobody ever cares who a clapper is. To the public, all clappers are the same.
But you're different from those others, Lev. You're a clapper who didn't clap. I wanted to.
If you wanted to, you would have. But instead, you ran into the wreckage and pulled out four people.
Three.
Three. But you probably would have gone in for more if you could have. The other tithes, they all stayed back. They protected their own precious parts. But you basically led that rescue effort, because there were terribles who followed you in to bring out survivors. Lev remembers that. Even as the mob was crashing down the gate, there were dozens of unwinds going back into the wreckage with him. And Pastor Dan is right. Lev would have kept going back in, but then it occurred to him that one false move would have set him off and brought the rest of the chop shop down around them. So he went back out to the red carpet and sat with Risa and Connor until ambulances took them away. Then he stood in the midst of the chaos and confessed to being a clapper. He confessed over and over again to anyone willing to listen, until finally a police officer kindly offered to arrest him. The officer was afraid to even handcuff Lev for fear of detonating him, but that was all right. He had no intention of resisting arrest.
What you did, Lev, it confused people. No one knows whether you're a monster or a hero.
Lev thinks about that. Is there a third choice? Pastor Dan doesn't answer him. Maybe he doesn't know the answer.
I have to believe that things happen for a reason. You're kidnapping, you're becoming a clapper, you're refusing to clap.
He glances at the magazine cover in his hand.
It's all led to this. For years, unwinds were just faceless kids that no one wanted. But now you've put a face on unwinding.
Can they put my face on someone else? Pastor Dan chuckles again, and this time it's not as forced as before. He looks at Lev like he's just a kid and not something inhuman. It makes him feel, if only for a moment, like a normal 13-year-old. It's a strange feeling, because even in his old life he never really was a normal kid. Tithes never are.
So what happens now? Lev asks.
The way I understand it, they'll clear the worst of the explosive out of your bloodstream in a few weeks. You'll still be volatile, but not as bad as before. You can clap all you want and you won't explode.
but I wouldn't play any contact sports for a while.
And then they'll unwind me?
Pastor Dan shakes his head.
They won't unwind a clapper. That stuff never entirely gets out of your system.
I've been talking to your lawyer. He has a feeling they're going to offer you a deal. After all, you did help them catch that group who gave you the transfusion to begin with. Those people who used you, they'll get what they deserve. And the courts are likely to see you as a victim.
I knew what I was doing, Lev tells him. Then tell me why you did it.
Lev opens his mouth to speak, but he can't put it into words. Anger, betrayal, fury at a universe pretending to be fair and just. But was that really a reason? Was that justification?
You may be responsible for your actions, Pastor Dan says, but it's not your fault you weren't emotionally prepared for life out there in the real world.
That was my fault, and the fault of everyone who raised you to be a tithe. We are as guilty as the people who pumped that poison into your blood. He looks away in shame, curbing his own growing anger. But Lev can tell it's not anger aimed at him. He takes a deep breath and continues.
The way the winds are blowing, you'll probably serve a few years of juvenile detention and a few more years of house arrest.
Lev knows he should be relieved by this, but the feeling is slow in coming. He considers the idea of house arrest.
Whose house? He asks.
He can tell Pastor Dan reads everything between the lines of that question.
You have to understand, Lev, your parents are the kind of people who can't bend without breaking. Whose house?
Pastor Dan sighs.
When your parents signed the unwind order, you became a ward of the state. After what happened at the harvest camp, the state offered to return custody to your parents, but they refused it. I'm sorry.
Lev is not surprised. He's horrified, but not surprised. Thoughts of his parents bring up the old feelings that drove him crazy enough to become a clapper. But now he finds that sense of despair is no longer bottomless.
So is my last name Ward now?
Not necessarily. Your brother Marcus is petitioning for guardianship. If he gets it, you'll be in his care whenever they let you go. So you'll still be a Calder. That is, if you want to
be. Lev nods his approval, thinking back to his tithing party and how Marcus was the only one to stand up for
him. Lev hadn't understood it at the
time. My parents disowned Marcus, too.
At least he knows he'll be in good company. Pastor Dan straightens out his shirt and shivers a bit from the cold. He doesn't really look like himself today. This is the first time Lev has seen him without his pastor's clothes.
Why are you dressed like that anyway?
He takes a moment before he answers. I resigned my position. I left the church. The thought of Pastor Dan being anything but Pastor Dan throws Lev for a loop.
You lost your faith?
No, he says. Just my convictions. I still very much believe in God. Just not a God who condones human tithing. Lev begins to feel himself choking up with an unexpected flood of feeling. All the emotions that had been building up throughout their talk, throughout the weeks, arriving all at once like a sonic boom.
I never knew that was a choice.
All his life there was only one thing Lev was allowed to believe. It had surrounded him, cocooned him, constricted him with the same stifling softness as the layers of insulation around him now. For the first time in his life, Lev feels those bonds around his soul begin to loosen.
You think maybe I can believe in that God too?
69. Unwinds. There's a sprawling ranch in West Texas. The money to build it came from oil that had long since dried up, but the money remained and multiplied. Now there's a whole compound, an oasis as green as a golf course in the middle of the flat, wild plains. This is where Harlan Dunphy grew to the age of 16, finding trouble along the way. He was arrested for disorderly behavior twice in Odessa. But his father, a big-shot admiral, got him off both times. The third time,
his parents came up with a different solution. Today is Harlan Dunphy's 26th birthday. He's having a party, of sorts. There are hundreds of guests at Harlan's party. One of them is a boy by the name of Zachary, though his friends know him as Emby. He's been living here at the ranch for some time now, waiting for this day. He has Harlan's right lung. Today he gives it back to Harlan. At the same time, 600 miles to the west, a wide-bodied jet lands in an airplane graveyard. The jet is full of crates, and each crate contains 4 unwinds. As the crates are opened, a teenage boy peers out of one, not sure what to expect. He's faced by a flashlight, and when the flashlight lowers, he can see that it's not an adult who opened the crate, but another kid. He wears khaki clothes, and he smiles at them, showing braces on a set of teeth that don't seem to need them.
"Hi, my name's Hayden, and I'll be your rescuer today," he announces. "Is everyone safe and sound in there?"
"We're fine," says the young unwind. "Where are we?"
"Purgatory," says Hayden, also known as Arizona.
The young unwind steps out of the crate, terrified of what might be in store for him. He stands in the processional of kids being herded along and, against Hayden's warning, bangs his head on the door of the cargo hold as he steps out. The harsh light of day and the blistering heat assault him as he walks down a ramp to the ground. He can tell this isn't an airport, and yet there are planes everywhere. In the distance, a golf cart rolls toward them, kicking up a plume of red dust. The crowd falls silent as it approaches. As it comes to a stop, the driver steps out. He's a man with serious scars over half of his face. The man speaks quietly for a moment with Hayden, then addresses the crowd. It's then that the young unwind realizes this is not a man, but just another kid. One not much older than himself. Perhaps it's the scars on his face that make him look older. Or maybe it's just the way he carries himself. "Let me be the first to welcome you all to the graveyard," he says. "Officially, my name is E. Robert Mullard," he smiles. "But everyone calls me Connor." The Admiral never returned to the graveyard. His health would not allow it. Instead, he's at his family's Texas ranch, in the care of a wife who left him years before. Although he's weak and can't get around well anymore, he hasn't changed much.
"The doctors say only 25% of my heart is still alive," he tells anyone who asks. "It'll do."
What has kept him alive more than anything else is the prospect of Harlan's big party. You could say that those terrifying stories about Humphrey Dunphy are true. At last, all his parts have been found. All the recipients have been gathered. But there will be no surgeries here. In spite of the rumors, rebuilding Harlan piece by piece was never the plan. But the Dunphys are putting their son together in the only meaningful way they can. He's here even now, as the Admiral and his wife step into their garden. He's in the voices of their many party guests, talking and laughing. There are men and women of all ages. Each wears a name tag, but there are no names on those tags. Today, names are unimportant. "Right hand," reads the sticker on one young man's lapel. He couldn't be any older than 25.
"Let me see," says the Admiral.
The man holds out his hand. The Admiral looks it over until he finds a scar between the thumb and forefinger.
"I took Harlan fishing when he was 9. He got that scar trying to gut a trout."
And then there's a voice from behind him, another man, a little bit older than the first.
"I remember,"
he says. The Admiral smiles. Perhaps the memories are spread out, but they're here, every one of them. He catches that boy who insists on calling himself Emby milling around at the edge of the garden by himself, wheezing less now that he's finally been put on the proper asthma medication.
"What are you doing over here?" the Admiral asks. "You should be over with the others."
"I don't know anybody."
"Yes, you do," says the Admiral. "You just don't realize it yet."
And he leads Emby toward the crowd. Meanwhile, in the airplane graveyard, Connor speaks to the new arrivals as they stand outside the jet that brought them here. Connor is amazed that they listen to him. He's amazed that he actually commands their respect. He'll never get used to that.
You're all here because you were marked for unwinding but managed to escape, and, thanks to the efforts of many people, you found your way here. This will be your home until you turn 17 and become a legal adult. That's the good news. The bad news is that they know all about us. They know where we are and what we're doing. They let us stay here because they don't see us as a threat.
And then Connor smiles. Well, we're going to change that.
As Connor talks, he makes eye contact with every one of them, making sure he remembers each of their faces, making sure each of them feels recognized, unique, important.
Some of you have been through enough and just want to survive to 17, he tells them. I don't blame you. But I know that some of you are ready to risk everything to end unwinding once and for all.
Yeah!
Screams a kid from the back, and pumping his fist in the air, he begins chanting,
Happy Jack! Happy Jack!
A few kids join in, until everyone realizes this is not what Connor wants. The chants quickly die down.
We will not be blowing up chop shops, he says. We're not going to feed into their image of us as violent kids who are better off unwound. We will think before we act. And that's going to make it difficult for them. We'll infiltrate harvest camps and unite unwinds across the country. We'll free kids from buses before they even arrive. We will have a voice, and we will use it. We will make ourselves heard.
Now the crowd can't hold back their cheers, and this time Connor allows it. These kids have been beaten down by life, but there's an energy now in the graveyard that's beginning to fill each and every one of them. Connor remembers that feeling. He had it when he first arrived here.
I don't know what happens to our consciousness when we're unwound, says Connor. I don't even know when that consciousness starts, but I do know this.
He pauses to make sure all of them are listening.
We have a right to our lives.
The kids go wild.
We have a right to choose what happens to our bodies.
The cheers reach fever pitch.
We deserve a world where both these things are possible. And it's our job to help make that world.
Meanwhile, excitement is also building at the Dunphy Ranch. The buzz of conversations around the garden grows to a roar as more and more people connect. Emby shares his experience with a girl who has the left match to his right lung. A woman talks about a movie she never saw with a man who remembers the friends he never saw it with. And as the Admiral and his wife watch, something amazing happens. The conversations begin to converge, like water vapor crystallizing into the magnificent, unique form of a snowflake, the babble of voices coalesces into a single conversation.
Look over there. He fell off that wall when he was 6. Yes, I remember.
He had to wear a wrist brace for months.
The wrist still hurts when it rains.
He shouldn't have climbed the wall.
I had to. I was being chased by a bull. I was so scared.
The flowers in that field, do you smell them?
They remind me of that one summer.
When my asthma wasn't so bad.
And I felt like I could do anything.
Anything.
And the world was just waiting for me.
The Admiral grips his wife's arm. Neither can hold back their tears. Not tears of sorrow, but of awe. If the rest of his heart were to stop now, in this moment, the Admiral would die more content than any man on earth. He looks at the crowd and says weakly,
Harlan?
Every eye in the garden turns toward him. A man raises his hand to his throat, touching it gently, and says in a voice that is most definitely Harlan Dunphy's, just a bit older,
Dad?
The Admiral is so overwhelmed by emotion he cannot speak. And so his wife looks at the man before her, at the people beside her, at the crowd all around her, and she says,
Welcome home.
600 miles away in the airplane graveyard, a girl plays a grand piano sheltered beneath the wing of a battered jet that was once Air Force One. She plays with a rare sort of joy in defiance of her wheelchair, and her sonata lifts the spirits of all the new arrivals. She smiles at them as they go by and continues to play, making it clear that this furnace of a place, full of planes that cannot fly, is more than it seems. It is a womb of redemption for every unwind, and for all those who fought the Heartland War and lost, which was everybody. Connor lets Reese's music fill him as he watches the new arrivals being greeted by the thousands of kids already here. The sun has begun to set, taking the edge off the heat, and the rows of jets at this time of day create pleasing patterns of shadow on the hard earth. Connor has to smile. Even a place as harsh as this can be beautiful in a certain light. Connor takes it all in. The music, the voices, the desert, and the sky. He has his work cut out for him, changing the world and all, but things are already in motion. All he has to do is keep up the momentum. And he doesn't have to do it alone. He has Risa, Hayden, and every unwind here. Connor takes a deep breath and releases it along with his tension. At last, he allows himself the wonderful luxury of hope. We hope you have enjoyed our presentation of Unwind by Neil Schusterman. Copyright 2007 by Neil Schusterman. Performed by Luke Daniels. Directed by Jim Bond. Engineered by Matthew Kristoloff. Performance copyright 2008 Brilliance Audio. Recorded by arrangement with Simon & Schuster Books for Young Readers, an imprint of Simon & Schuster Children's Publishing Division. All rights reserved. For further information concerning this program or other Brilliance Audio titles, please call the following toll-free number, 1-800-222-3225, or visit our website at www.brillianceaudio.com. No part of this recording may be played for an audience or reproduced in any form. It may not be streamed, downloaded, broadcast, or copied without written permission. Address all inquiries to Brilliance Audio, P.O. Box 887, Grand Haven, Michigan, 49417.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.